So we've been sort of following this this story, and there's always a cliffhanger at the end of each chapter. Remember that? Okay, this is kind of silly. I'm sorry, but if you ever watched Between the Lions, kids, you ever see that? At the end of every show, they had Cliff, the hanger, hanging from a cliff. That was good. But Esther has these built into every chapter, and there's a lot of drama in this story, and it's not overdone. Chris McMillan shared with me this past week a discussion that he had from a Bible study recently at Southern New Hampshire Universities. One of the students is kind of exploring Christianity, very skeptical of it, really doesn't believe it, but really wants to learn about what Christianity is. And of course, you know, we believe God can use all kinds of motives. So one of the questions that he asked was a question that I know I've asked before, probably you asked before too. What difference does Christianity make in your life? You know, that's what he wanted to know. How does Christianity make your life better? How is it, you know, how is it change the way that you live? And I think it's a great question to ask today on Reformation Sunday. Because if, as Martin Luther claimed, if we're saved by faith alone, then what difference does that faith make? What does that faith produce in our lives that wouldn't be there otherwise if we didn't have it? Well, in this chapter, we really get a chance to see that. We get to see two very different people who both have faith, you know, one, of course, in God, and one in themselves. And we're going to see what that faith produces, what difference it makes in the way that they live. Well, the drama kind of left us hanging at the end of chapter 4 when Esther decided she was going to approach the king uninvited, and she said the sort of fateful words, "If I perish, I perish." And this really was not an idle threat. There are a couple of sculptures that are called bas reliefs that have been excavated from a Persian city called Persepolis. It was the ancient Persian city of Parsa. And it showed a Persian king. Because of the dates that the city was built, it had to be either Darius or Xerxes. Darius was Xerxes' father. So it showed the Persian king on his throne, and he has a long scepter in his right hand. And behind him, behind his throne, is a soldier with an axe. So you get the idea. If he doesn't, you know, if he doesn't lift the scepter, you know, you either get the scepter or the axe. And you want the scepter. Definitely want the scepter. So Esther knew that death was a possibility. And for her, she thought, really, maybe a likelihood, because the king seemed to have kind of lost interest in her. She hadn't been summoned for 30 days, which is a long time in that situation. So the author sets the stage with a lot of drama. Esther stands, just kind of picture this. She stands in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. So she's basically facing Xerxes, and there's no doors, you know, as far as we can tell. Esther positioned herself so that as soon as the king looked up, he would be staring right at her. And unlike the time that she was summoned to see him when she was in the harem, you know, during this beauty contest that was taking place, Esther doesn't appeal to his desire for her. Note what she wears. She wears her royal robes. Karen Job says that as Esther identifies with her people, she also claims her authority and power as the queen of Persia. And verse 2 tells us, when Xerxes saw her, she won favor in his sight. So, you know, phew, made it past the first danger. But this is sort of an aside, really doesn't have anything to do with the theme of the passage, but isn't it just ridiculously sad that a woman had to live in that kind of fear of her husband? I mean, think about the way that the Bible describes the role of a husband and a wife. You know, a husband is to love his wife, to provide security, to care for her, to protect her. And here is this woman who had to be afraid, literally, that her husband was going to kill her. You know, it just tells you how radically different the whole philosophy of the kingdom of Persia was from what God set out. So Xerxes holds out the scepter to Esther, but I want you to notice what he says in verse 3. He says, "What is it, Queen Esther?" Well, it's the first time that anybody calls her Queen Esther. And I think the author is showing us an incredible transformation of this young girl from being, you know, just a scared victim of circumstance to a great woman of courage. 14 times she's called Queen Esther in the book. All but one of those references comes from chapter 5 on. So only one time before that is she called Queen Esther. So there's the way that the author tells the story, he's emphasizing her authority and even her power from this point forward. And again, Job said that her transformation comes from the moment that she decides to identify herself with God's covenant. So, you know, make no mistake, this took real courage. You know, she had no guarantee that God would take care of her. I don't know that she remembered God's promise to Abraham about blessing the nations. She may have, she may not have. Even if she knew that, though, you know, she didn't know that that was going to mean her life. And I honestly do think that there is a difference in the Queen Esther in the first couple of chapters of this book and the one here. Because in both cases, she wins the favor of the king. In fact, the language is exactly the same. The grammar is the same. But the difference here is not what she did. It's not the fact that the king was pleased in her, but it's what she was trusting in. Now, you know, we don't know what she was trusting in early in the book, but we know here that she has asked people to pray for 3 days, day and night. So we know that the prayers of God's people carried her. Her faith gave her the courage to look fear in the eye and then keep going. I was thinking about the fact that courage in our culture is portrayed in a lot of different ways. Usually it's machismo and bravado. You know, it's all these action movies. Whenever people think about courage, they think about, you know, jumping out of a helicopter or you know, committing an act of war or, you know, something that has to do with something that's really physically hard to do. And, you know, that's definitely a part of it. But when you think about it, the dictionary definition of courage is strength in the face of pain, fear, or grief. It doesn't have to be any kind of a physical courage. And so, yes, sometimes it is necessary to fight, and that does take courage. But I would argue that it takes more courage not to fight when that's actually the better course. Don't you think? I mean, you know, you remember those of you that grew up and got bullied by bigger kids, you knew there were situations where it was not best to fight back. There were situations where it was more courageous. You know, the sports illustration that comes to mind is Jackie Robinson. You know, here's somebody who was in a situation where he was getting yelled at, cussed at. Just people were saying terrible, terrible things to him. Hank Aaron had the same experience. I was listening to an interview this week on a sports talk show, and they were talking to Hank Aaron, and I guess when he was getting ready to overtake Babe Ruth's home run record, he ended up with 755, and Babe Ruth had, I don't know, 715 or somewhere in there, but he was getting ready to pass Babe Ruth, and he got just vitriolic letters, death threats. I mean, literally, he had to pass these on to the police because they had to take them seriously because he was black and Babe Ruth was white. And there was just tremendous anger and hatred out there. And I was just amazed in listening to this man talk. What a gracious man he is. He's I think he's 82. Or is it late 70s or early 80s? And he's talking to Dan Patrick, the sports talk show host. And at the end of the interview, he says, "Dan, I just want to thank you. I want to thank you for talking to me. And you have a great show." I was thinking, this is one of the greatest baseball players that ever lived. You know, who's Dan Patrick to him? It doesn't mean anything. But that's a gracious spirit. It just really struck me as somebody that has a man of courage. But oftentimes, and Jackie Robinson had to, you know, he had to exhibit courage without fighting. I posted a video on C-Chair's Facebook page this week, and part of it shows an interview with Ravi Zacharias, who you may have heard of. He's a Christian apologist. He's someone who defends the faith. does a lot of debating with people who aren't Christians. So he was telling a story of a Christian professor of geology at an Islamic university in, it was Malaysia, not Morocco. So this guy was a Christian professor at an Islamic university in Malaysia. Now you can imagine there probably aren't very many Christian professors at that university. And at this time, I think he was the only one. So one day they had a Muslim debater who came to the school and he addressed this assembly. So hundreds of students, I don't know how many, but a large crowd. And so this man got up in the assembly and he just openly mocked this Christian professor by name. Just ripped him apart, made fun of him. And so the Christian professor stood up, which took a lot of guts, I think, just to stand up in the crowd and say, why are you mocking my faith? And so the cleric said, because it's a farce. Take the Sermon on the Mount. Nobody can keep the commands in the Sermon on the Mount. And the professor said, why do you say that? So the man said, come up on stage. So the professor came up on stage and he stood opposite the Muslim cleric. And the cleric just slapped him as hard as he could, right across the face. And he said, now turn the other cheek. And this man was telling Ravi Zacharias later, he said, my face was literally ringing with this slap. But he did. He turned the other cheek. And I don't think that was what the Muslim cleric was expecting. And so he said, all right, we're going to go a different direction now. He said, something else that Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount is, if someone takes your cloak, give them your coat as well. He said, take off your pants. So the Christian professor looked out at the crowd of college students, and many of them were his students, and he said, please forgive me. And he took off his pants. So he's standing there in his underwear in front of this cleric and in front of hundreds and hundreds of students. And the cleric just mocked him mercilessly, laughed at him, made fun of him. And that was his whole point. And so the professor picked up his pants and walked off the stage. The next day, outside of his office, he had a line of Muslim students stretching out into the hallway, dozens and dozens of students begging his forgiveness for what this Muslim cleric had done. Because they knew it was horribly, horribly wrong. Now, don't you think that because you may look at that and say, well, why would you do that? That was really, you made yourself look like a fool. Why would you do that? But isn't the whole point of the Sermon on the Mount that we as God's people don't exist to defend ourselves and to defend our rights, but we let it go? He was letting even his dignity go for the sake of modeling what Jesus had taught. And don't you think that his opportunities with those Muslim students multiplied exponentially after that? It took a lot of courage, and took a lot more courage than to do what he wanted to do, which was to haul back and hit that guy even harder. Okay, second thing I want to show you is that faith produces resourcefulness. So faith produces courage and resourcefulness. We already learned with Esther, she's a very resourceful girl. She knows how to use the resources at her disposal to give her an advantage. So in her response to the king, we see how she used those gifts in cooperation with her faith. In verse 4, she answered Xerxes' question with an invitation to dinner with Haman, which I think it's kind of funny that she doesn't say, I want you to come to a dinner I have prepared for you and Haman. She says, I want you and Haman to come to a dinner I have prepared for you. I think that's on purpose. Anyway, that's sort of beside the point. But so she invites him to dinner, and Xerxes is very eager to reply. He gets Haman, he goes to the dinner. After the feast, they're just relaxing, drinking wine. And so the king is curious. He asks her again. And again, he promises half the kingdom. He says, what do you want? So the way that Esther responded is really, really important. She began with a question. In the original, you don't see that in the English, but in the original, she began with a question. My response and my petition? So she acted as if she was going to answer him, and then she stopped, kind of broke off, and started again. So by answering that way, she highlighted how serious this request was, and she kind of piqued the king's interest. And so now the king's ringing, what in the world are you going to ask me? This has got to be a big deal. So then when she asks this question, stops. When she starts again, she uses a doubly polite phrase. She used a passive instead of an active term, and she's trying to demonstrate this quality of meekness that she knows Xerxes is drawn to. So literally, Esther says, if granting what I ask and fulfilling my request please the king, let him come to the banquet I prepare tomorrow. But do you see what she did in the way that she phrased that? She responded to the king's request that she share her request, and she made it sound like she was doing the king a favor instead of the other way around. She's like, okay, I'll grant your request that I ask you for something. But the way that she phrased it made it seem like she was helping him. And so in this situation, he had no choice but to do what she asked, because otherwise he would lose face. Now, this is a smart lady here. And this part reminds me of Tom Sawyer, who, you remember Aunt Polly got on his case because he skipped school, and so she said, you got to whitewash the fence. And so he gets all his friends are walking by, and he's whitewashing the fence, and he manages to convince them that whitewashing the fence is such an enjoyable job that they really ought to pay him for the privilege of doing it. And good salesman. So Esther is using her skills to get the king to do what she wants. But here's the difference between what happened here and what happened back in chapter 2. The difference is it's not just her position on the line. It's not, you know, getting into the king's, becoming queen even. It's not an advantage that's on the line. It's her life. And not only her life, it's the fate of her entire race of people in the kingdom of Persia. And something that heavy could only be undergirded by faith. There's no way she could do that on her own. So faith does produce resourcefulness. Third thing is that faith produces worship. So now we get to talk about our friend Haman again. Haman left the banquet joyful and glad of heart. Now, where do you hear those terms, joyful and glad of heart? Well, I mean, they show up throughout the Bible, right? They show up all over the Psalms to describe people who worship. You know, when we worship, we're joyful, we're glad of heart. But when Haman, and Haman feels that way, he's you know, just on cloud nine. But then he walks by Mordecai, who's at the king's gate, and everything, all of his joy evaporates, and it gets replaced by anger. Remember, Haman's name means wrath. And there's a reason for that. So not only did Mordecai not get up and show honor to Haman, he basically ignored him, just pretended to not even notice that he was there. And that just absolutely lit Haman's fuse. It was all he could do to restrain himself until he got home. But he did. But then notice what he does when he gets home. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. I mean, does his wife not know how many children he has? You ever think about that? I mean, I think she would know. This is not news to them. I'm sure that Haman recited this stuff all the time about how great he was and all of these accomplishments. And then Haman says, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow I'm invited as well. So this is the deal. Can you tell where Haman's joy and gladness of heart come from? What we learn in this little scene is that Haman is a man of faith, just like Esther's a woman of faith. But his faith is in himself. He is the center of his universe. He has an idol of public attention. And we know that because when his idol is stroked, when his idol is appeased, as it was at the feast with the king and Esther, it brings him incredible joy, like surpassing joy. But then when his idol is challenged, as it was with Mordecai, he's insanely angry. I mean, over the top angry. And that's why he says in verse 13, all of this, all of these accomplishments, all of these wonderful things that I've been given are worth nothing to me as long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. What is an idol? An idol is an object of devotion. It's any person or thing or idea that gives us a sense of ultimate worth. If I could just have that, then everything would be great. Then my life would be everything I could ever imagine. That's an idol. Anything like that, obviously, when it's appeased, it's wonderful. But when it isn't, when it's challenged, it produces out-of-control anger. Ian Duguid points out that Haman, you know, had Haman gotten some counsel, you know, against letting his life revolve around himself, he might have saved his life as well as his soul. But he doesn't get it, and he certainly doesn't want it. His wife, now here's a little irony alert here. Beep, beep, beep. Irony alert. What did the king and his advisors tell the people of Persia that they had to do back at the beginning in chapter 1? You remember they sent out this decree on all the, you know, with the Pony Express to all the places in the kingdom. And they said, make sure, husbands, make sure you rule your homes. Okay? Isn't that funny? How is Haman exactly ruling his home? His wife tells him, for that matter, how is Xerxes ruling his home? His wife tells him to build a gallows 75 feet high to hang Mordecai. Now, here's the thing. For maximum public attention. That's why she says build it 75 feet high. Everybody in Susa will be able to see it. But you see, this was Zeresh's solution for Haman's woes. You know, it's a little bit like Jezebel and Ahab. But her solution fed his idolatry rather than starving it. Because what was going to happen? If Mordecai gets hanged on this 75-foot gallows, Haman's public attention is going to go through the roof, even while Mordecai's is destroyed. So faith produces worship of one kind or another. Just depends who you're worshiping. That video that I posted on Facebook, the interview I talked about before was kind of in the middle to the end. The beginning of the video showed a clip of Richard Dawkins, who's an Oxford professor and atheist and you know, loves to debate Christians. Showed him speaking at a rally in Washington, D.C., and it was some kind of like an atheist rally on the Mall in Washington. And so he was speaking at this rally, and he was urging atheists to mock religion. He said, don't fall for the civil convention that religion is to be off the table. Religion makes claims that must be substantiated and, if necessary, mocked with contempt publicly. And, of course, the crowd loved to hear that. You know, they're just cheering and... So later in this interview with Ravi Zacharias, he was asked about this comment by Dawkins. And the first thing he said, and I thought this was actually pretty funny, he said, I would like to see Professor Dawkins say that in Saudi Arabia. And I thought, yeah, I would like to see him do that here. He's really brave in the confines of his own country. He's not going to do that in a country where they'll chop off his head if he says that. But he went on to say, The comments that Dawkins made are not new. He said, you know, people have been doing this for thousands of years. They foster an animosity that makes it impossible to dialogue about faith at all. You know, you can't have a civil dialogue with somebody like that. And Zacharias said, Dawkins is an angry man. And he said his comments feed an attitude that is very dangerous. And I couldn't agree more. But the thing about Richard Dawkins is he's no less a worshiper than the Christians he makes fun of. Because his mockery feeds his idols. Now, I don't know exactly what his idols are, but I can kind of guess. Maybe he has an idol of control. His mockery of Christians feeds his idolatry. Okay, so let's talk about us. Because it's easy to you know, look at an atheist and say, oh man, that's a really bad man. But do we have problems with idolatry? You better believe we do. When you look through the Old Testament, in the experiences of the nation of Israel, it was a constant temptation. Idolatry was a constant temptation. And our idols today are different. You know, they're not what the Israelites struggled with, but they're no less powerful. So I just want to give you an illustration of my own, okay? Kind of burying my soul here. So... We've just ended the soccer season in our house, and I was watching one of my son's soccer games recently, and I found that as the game was going on, I was getting more and more agitated and frustrated. And it just seemed to me, from my completely unbiased perspective, that the other team was getting away with a lot of, you know, elbow action, a lot of extracurricular activity in going for the ball, and a lot of pushing, and the referee just wasn't calling it. And we sort of had a history with this particular team, who will go unmentioned. But finally towards the end of the game, there was this pretty egregious play where the guy on the other team just kind of threw his elbow and just about knocked our player over. And I just couldn't contain myself, and I said, "Ref, can you please make a call? They've been doing this the whole game." And the ref was like 10 feet away, and I said it a lot louder than that, actually. So it was definitely loud enough for him to hear. So in my mind, my wife was rather critical of my attitude at this point. And in my mind, I was just helping the ref out. I mean, he just missed it. I mean, it's kind of obvious, but maybe he just needed a little help. So she didn't really buy that argument. But as I was thinking this week, I'm reading this passage and thinking about this idea of idolatry. And then it suddenly just hit me like a ton of bricks. How do we know that we have an idol? Well, when it gets appeased, we're extremely happy. When it gets challenged, we're extremely angry. Had we scored in that game, which we didn't, but had we scored in that game, and furthermore, had we won that game, you know how happy I would have been? Holy cow, I would have been running laps around that field, screaming, in the presence of the ref. No, I would have been, just unbelievably happy. But when my team lost, I felt cheated. I felt wronged. And I realized that I had made, in that moment, I had made an idol of the attention of athletic success. And it was vicarious because I wasn't on the field. I wasn't even playing the game. That doesn't keep parents from doing this. You see, that's why my anger was out of proportion with what actually happened. Because that was an idolatry. To win that game was an idolatry for me. Because I wanted to feel validated. I wanted my team to beat those people because we're better than them. And so that's my issue. So what about you? What or who, besides God, produces great happiness when things go right and great anger when they don't? Is it a relationship? Is it a possession? Is it changing the oil in your car? Is it dealing with your boss? Is it a need to be right in an argument? What is underneath all of those idols? It's the idol of self. You see, when our lives revolve around ourselves, we become trapped in the cycle where we've got to satisfy those desires or we are miserable. But you see, God made us to find joy in Him. And when we find joy in Him instead of the things He gives us, then we don't ride up and down so much when the circumstances change, when the things don't go our way. As we give Him glory with our lives, we can freely use the things that He provides. We don't have to find our joy in those things. So how do we do that? How do we find joy in God? Well, for us to gain access into God's presence is very different from what it took Esther to gain access into Xerxes' presence. But you know what? It's no less dangerous. The passage opens. I found this really fascinating. The passage opens by telling us it was on the third day that Esther approached the king. Remember, she had asked the people to fast for, I guess it'd be 72 hours, a day and night for 3 days. And so my guess is that it was after sunset, because the Jewish day ended at sunset. It was after 6 o'clock p.m. on the third day that she went to the king, because that was when the fast was completed. There's a Jewish midrash. It's a rabbinic commentary on this particular passage. It points out that Israel is never left in distress more than 3 days. And so this commentary goes on to compare this circumstance with a couple of others. Abraham and Genesis 22, remember, he goes up with Isaac, and God says, "I want you to sacrifice your son." And he goes up and he carries the wood and And Isaac says, well, where's the ram? And he says, well, God will provide the ram. Well, it was on the third day that God provided the ram. Another example it gives is Jonah the prophet. He was freed from the whale on the third day. Jacob and Laban, when Jacob is at his uncle Laban's and he is, you know, really mistreated, he escapes on the third day. So you have this theme throughout the Bible about this third day. Hosea 6:2 is kind of all based on this principle. Hosea said, after 2 days he will revive us. On the third day he will restore us that we may live in his presence. See, the good news is that God always saves in 3 days. We don't have to enter God's presence uninvited because Jesus did it for us. But here's the thing. Jesus went into God's presence, in a sense, uninvited. And instead of God extending the scepter, he brought down the rod of his wrath on Jesus in anger because of the sin that Jesus carried for me. And that's why Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? But there was no other day, other way. But the Bible tells us that on the third day, God breathed new life into that broken body. And that's why we can call God Father. That's why we can enjoy his presence. So if you have never put your faith in Jesus Christ, today would be a great day. This is the first day, but it doesn't have to be the third day. If you've never done that, this would be a wonderful day to do that. And if you have put your faith in Jesus, and if you're struggling with idols of the heart, because guess what? You are. I didn't ask you to share yours with me. You can do that later. But you are. Every one of us struggles with idols of the heart. Come back to the one who made you and gave his son to rescue you. Because you know what? No idol will ever do that. Your idol will simply try to reflect you. Your idol will never give itself for you. That's the difference. Let's pray together. God in heaven, I thank you for this view that we get into the life of Esther and Mordecai and the power of what faith that produces, the faith that you give as a gift, the kind of character that it produces in us. And Lord, I pray on this Reformation Sunday that you would just help us to revel in that faith that you've given us. Help us to revel in the relationship that we have with you. And Lord, help us to respond in worship. Help us to live authentically before our friends and our neighbors and to share our faith eagerly. And Father, we thank you that you are the one, as we talked about in Veritas, for all the effort that we expend, you are the one who works in us to work according to your pleasure. And we thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.